Good morning, I'm Tommy Howell, and welcome to another edition of Tree Huggers International on KBZT FM 94.9, a weekly natural science and environmental affairs program for the listeners of FM 94.9 and San Diego and all of Southern California, from the beaches to the mountains to the deserts. This is Tree Huggers International. Be careful and use this show with caution, because you might just learn something. The Zoological Society of San Diego operates two of San Diego's most popular destinations for tourists and locals alike, the San Diego Zoo and the San Diego Zoo's Wild Animal Park in the San Pasqual Valley near Escondido. Believe it or not, the Society is the largest zoological membership association in the world, and it functions as a conservation, education, and recreation organization dedicated to the reproduction and protection of animals, plants, and their habitats. They're a great conservation neighbor, and we're lucky to have them here in our end of Southern California. And joining us today from the Zoological Society of San Diego is Dr. Ron Swaysgood, the Director of Applied Animal Ecology at the San Diego Zoo's Institute for Conservation Research. Dr. Swaysgood supervises several recovery programs for species like the California condor, endangered Hawaiian birds, the San Clemente Island loggerhead shrike, Caribbean rock iguanas, mountain yellow-legged frogs, and prior to coming to work for the zoo, he spent a great deal of time in southern Africa working with rhinoceroses and in China working with China's national treasure, the giant panda. Dr. Swaysgood has also tackled conservation problems related to captive breeding and reintroduction, and he's in charge of the research end of the San Diego Zoo's ongoing desert tortoise project in conjunction with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And we're very, very lucky to have him here with us this morning. We're going to talk all about the desert tortoise and some other animals. Dr. Ron Swaysgood, welcome to Tree Huggers International. It's great to have you here today.
Well, thanks, Tommy. It's great to be here.
I know you're a UNC grad, so first of all, congratulations on this year's Tar Heels victory in the NCAAs.
Go Heels.
Nice job. You attended grad school at UC Davis. Did you go there to study animal behavior?
I did. UC Davis actually has the largest animal behavior graduate program in the world, so it was a terrific place to go. It was a very exciting intellectual environment, and I learned all the tools that I use here at the San Diego Zoo to study animals.
Was that your first stop in California? Had you been anywhere else before?
No, I packed up my truck, moved from South Carolina at the time, and headed for California for the first time. I didn't know what I was getting into.
So in my introduction, I named several specifically California animals in varying states of conservation, like the condor, the San Clemente loggerhead shrike, and the desert tortoise, which isn't entirely about California, but this is a rather far-ranging question. But can you explain why these species' habitats are so particular to our state?
Well, first, our state is an incredible natural, has incredible natural resources. We have a very high level of biodiversity, and San Diego County actually has some of the highest levels of biodiversity in the country. And so we do have a lot of unique habitats. Only places like San Diego can you go from the coast to chaparral to mountain forest to desert in an hour and a half's drive. So we do have a lot of very unique habitats that support a lot of very unique and interesting species right here in our backyard.
The condor in particular was this remarkable success story with what seems to be in some ways a rebooting of the species in the 80s and since then. Has there ever been a conservation effort as comprehensive that you're aware of as the one that applied to the condor?
Now, the condor is certainly one of the most comprehensive and largest and long-term conservation programs, recovery programs for a species. There are some that approach the size. Golden line tamarins, there's been a huge effort to reintroduce them in the Atlantic rainforest in Brazil. But, the condor is one of the largest ever. Our panda program is one that's it's a little newer. We've only been doing it for 10 or 15 years. But it's one that's approaching condors in terms of the amount of effort over the years that's been put into it.
Now, you spent some significant time in China working with pandas before you were doing this particular job. Did the Chinese government, did they do anything official in the way of conservation as far as the pandas go?
Oh, the Chinese government is very involved in panda conservation. It's their national treasure. and they've put tremendous resources. Since I started working with pandas in the mid-90s, the Chinese government has gone from 10 reserves established to protect pandas to over 60 reserves to protect pandas. So they do put tremendous resources and attention into preservation of the species.
Whereabouts in the country are they located?
Pandas are in three provinces, Sichuan, Gansu, and Shaanxi province, kind of central west China, native to the mountainous regions there. They live in the bamboo forest.
And how did the San Diego Zoo become involved with panda conservation? And certainly having pandas for display, it's pretty unusual and pretty remarkable.
Yeah, that was that's a whole story in and of itself. It was a long effort to get this long-term panda conservation loan. We've imported a pair of pandas in 1996, and we started a large-scale conservation science program. First, we worked with some conservation breeding activities. Unfortunately, years ago, pandas didn't quite know how to do what comes naturally, at least in the breeding environments that we'd set up for them. So I spent many months a year working in China at a breeding facility in the mountains there in the Wolong Nature Reserve, trying to figure out ways to improve the mating program. And that's turned around now. We've gone from about 25 pandas at that facility to 130-some. So the population is exploding. And, of course, we've had four cubs born right here in San Diego to our pair of pandas as well.
Those cubs are tiny when they're born, too. They're like a stick of butter.
Yeah, they're about 4 ounces. Look like a little pink rodent when they're first born, and then the black markings start to come in when they're about 10 days old.
Why is it that pandas have become endangered in China? Is there any reason for that? Is it humans or is it just evolution?
No, clearly pandas have declined because of human population pressures and habitat loss. In fact, we think of pandas as being a mountain species, but thousands of years ago, pandas roamed throughout lower elevations in China. But of course, at that time, there was a bamboo forest habitat there. But of course, that was cut down to make white room for farms and people. And what we have left now is a series of islands of habitat that remain in the mountains. But left to their own devices, pandas, they live in a sea of their own food. These bamboo forests are just that. The bamboo is so thick you can hardly walk through it. I've nearly lost an eye on a piece of bamboo trying to force my way through some of the panda trails there. Yeah, they do fine in their natural habitat. And that's why the Chinese government and San Diego Zoo and other organizations, we know that we can recover this species. It just takes a little effort.
About what elevation do they live at?
They can be found at elevations of about 4,000 feet to 8,000 or 9,000 feet. Above that, you lose the forest, you get into the alpine region.
And you spent a lot of time in Africa as well, working with rhinoceros.
Yes.
Can you talk about that a bit?
Oh, Africa's a fabulous place. I've worked in South Africa and Namibia primarily. And one of the programs I worked with most extensively was with black rhinoceros and translocation. I've sort of become a specialist in how to relocate animals into new areas. And in the case of black rhinos, they were decimated by poaching, and the population was starting to recover, but they were only present in a few reserves. And so the governments of Southern Africa started moving rhinos out of areas where they were doing well to repopulate other reserves around Africa. And so we radio-collared and tracked nearly 100 of these rhinos that were relocated and tried to learn how they adjust to that novel environment when they're released, and been working with them to increase the success rate of those translocations, they're called.
I've never been to Africa, but it always struck me that rhinoceros don't necessarily want to be in a desert environment. They want to be in a savanna, even a Mediterranean-like environment. Mm-hmm. And my idea of Namibia is always that being just this endless desert. Is that incorrect?
Well, Namibia does have a lot of desert, and the black rhinos in particular can live in desert thorn scrub, and they can be found in the desert areas. They also thrive in what's called the bush veldt, and those are fairly dry. They're not rhinos don't live in lush tropical rainforest type environments. The populations are certainly higher in areas where there's a bit more vegetation than some of the most desert areas.
So you were living in California, and you had studied in California, and then you spent some time in China and in Southern Africa. And I would imagine that your time in California might have in some way prepared you for going to these very different locations because we have all these climates, if you will, here in the Golden State.
Yeah, right here in San Diego. As I mentioned, we have we've got this beautiful coastal area where it's cool and moist, and you drive an hour and a half and you get to Anza Borrego, which is just a beautiful place, true wilderness. It's really a great opportunity to have a wilderness like that so close to a major civilization.
How did the zoo become involved with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the Bureau of Land Management's Desert Tortoise Conservation Center? And this is outside Las Vegas.
Yeah, that's right. The San Diego Zoo has a long history with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. We've partnered with them on so many programs, the condor being one of the most notable. Fish and Wildlife Service is very involved in our panda program. So we had a history of working together with them, Hawaiian endangered birds, San Clemente Island loggerhead shrikes. They had a facility for desert tortoises in Vegas. They were looking around for some new management, an organization that would use conservation science to help recover the species and use this as kind of a rescue center, use it as a conservation tool. And they thought of us, and they came to us, and we started talking about it. And as of March 1st of this year, the San Diego Zoo has taken over the operations of running that facility.
Your colleague, Alan Lieberman, who's the San Diego Zoo Conservation Research Program Manager, he said the health of the desert can be measured by the health of the tortoise, and the desert tortoise is truly the flagship species of the American Southwest. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, well, the desert tortoise, it really is. They're an icon for the southwestern desert, and they are, or were at least, one of the more common animals there. They're very well known and beloved by people. If you go to the neighborhoods around Las Vegas and other southern, southwestern desert areas, and you ask them, did they or did their friends have a tortoise when they were growing up, you get over half of the people responding yes. A lot of people in this region grew up with desert tortoises as pets. So they are well known and they are beloved. But they also play a really critical role in the ecology and the ecosystem of the deserts here. They're what we call an ecosystem engineer. They dig burrows that they require to hibernate and estivate during the heat of the summer. But many other species use those burrows. They're also great seed dispersers. In some areas where the habitat is favorable, you can have as many as 500 tortoises in a square mile. Unfortunately, those numbers are declining, but they are a very important part of the ecology here.
What is the range of that habitat?
The desert tortoise, there's two major populations here in the United States. One is the Mojave population, and that's the one that was listed by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in 1990 as threatened. And if that their range is the deserts of Southern California and Southern Nevada. And then the other major population is the Sonoran Desert in Arizona and northern Mexico.
Now, you'd mentioned that you were in Utah a couple of weeks ago when the NCAAs were going on, and there's some desert regions there in southern Utah, but that's not an area where you'd find desert tortoise.
Yes, their range does extend into southern Utah a bit as well.
Mm-hmm. Is that more of a Colorado desert climate there?
Yeah, that's and there is a smaller population in those areas.
So what is making the desert tortoise endangered? And this could be kind of a big question.
Right. The desert tortoise is suffering from many of the same ailments that so many of our species are today. The human populations expand and activities expand. We're having more and more effects on our local deserts here. And so there's a lot of development as the cities expand. There's building of roads. So this leads to habitat loss. There can be tortoises that are killed by roads, but also people and people structures bring other threats to the area that they weren't exposed to before. Dogs, for example, can take hatchlings. One unintended side effect of human occupation is an increase in the raven population. And the ravens are actually very ravenous predators of tortoise hatchlings. So they can potentially decimate local tortoise populations. Another reason for their decline might be a disease. They have an upper respiratory tract disease that they're susceptible to, and releases of pet tortoises may increase that. And there's some populations that where it's believed that they are declining because of diseases such as that.
Releases of pet tortoises?
Yeah.
And they don't jibe well with the wild desert tortoise?
Well, not if they're carrying pathogens, viruses, bacteria, mycoplasma. These are diseases that can potentially affect the wild resident tortoises. So it's not necessarily a good thing to release a pet tortoise, and certainly not without first screening them for these sorts of diseases.
If you're just joining us, this is Tree Huggers International on KBZT FM 94.9. I'm Tommy Helm, and joining us today is the Director of Applied Animal Ecology at the San Diego Zoo's Institute for Conservation Research, Dr. Ron Swaysgood. We're talking about Dr. Swaysgood and the zoo's and the San Diego Zoological Society's conservation efforts, not just here in California, but certainly around the world. For more information about the San Diego Zoo and the San Diego Zoological Society, go to www.sandiegozoo.org. Even better, try www.sandiegozoo.org/conservation. And you can also call 619-231-1515. That's 619-231-1515. And that's interesting that you mentioned ravens and also just household pets and pet tortoises, because I was going to ask if there were certain predators which benefited from overdevelopment, perhaps, or degradation of habitat. I spoke to a USGS scientist last year, and we were talking about mountain lions and how the building of roads or just frequently used trails, roads unofficial or official, can divide up habitat. And as a result, mountain lions simply won't cross it. And no matter how many areas you might put for a freeway, for a little underpass for animals to go as a corridor, they may not use it because that habitat, for some reason, has this very unnatural demarcation line for them. Mm-hmm. Does that apply to the desert tortoise as well?
Well, it certainly applies to desert tortoises because it carves up their habitat and it fragments it. And we don't know the extent to which it affects them. Certainly they can be killed crossing the roads, but also by bisecting these populations, it can inhibit gene flow. So over time, we could have loss of genetic diversity in these more isolated populations, which is known to happen in other species that suffer from habitat fragmentation. And the desert tortoise, in this case, we're operating the Desert Tortoise Conservation Center in Las Vegas. And we've hired a team of desert rats. We've got some great new staff to run it. Dr. Paula Kahn is the program manager. They have a lot of experience. They're cactus huggers, not tree huggers in this case, and have a lot of experience with desert tortoises. And we're going to do a number of studies and efforts to help conserve this species. For example, we're going to tackle the disease issues that I spoke to earlier. We have the only molecular diagnostics lab in a zoo in the country, and we're going to assemble a team of biologists to work on some of these disease issues and try to understand them better and develop even better screening tools to detect them. We're going to develop a large-scale translocation program because this facility receives hundreds and sometimes more than 1,000 tortoises in a year. And these are animals that are displaced from development or pets that are no longer wanted. And we care for them at the facility, and there's been a history of also releasing those. We want to use GPS satellite technology and track tortoises that we release. And, of course, we will screen them closely for diseases. People listening should not think that taking their pet tortoise out to the desert is a good idea. It has to be done very carefully and to make sure that we don't negatively impact the native populations that are there. So, yeah, we have a number of tools that we've developed in species conservation, and we're planning to apply those to the desert tortoise.
If there's a development going on someplace, are you able to go there ahead of time and rescue desert tortoise? Is that something that's even done? Or is it more a matter of taking tortoises that are found in an area being developed?
The answer would be all of the above. Clark County also has an active program where they rescue tortoises from areas that are being developed, and they have a hotline that you can call for pets or if tortoises are found wandering around places where they maybe isn't the safest place for them to be. And they come to us at the Desert Tortoise Conservation Center.
And how big are these desert tortoise?
Oh, yeah. Well, they're incredible. You should see them. They're very charismatic. They can be about a foot long, a little longer. And they can weigh 8, 10, even 15 pounds. So they get pretty big. As adults, they're virtually free of natural enemies because they're the hard shells. Mountain lions and coyotes can occasionally take them, but it requires a tremendous effort for them, and they probably, in the process, might break a tooth. It's in periods of drought that some of these predators try to go after the adults.
And what do the tortoise eat?
The tortoises are, of course, herbivores. They eat grasses and herbs, and they come out after the spring rain in the Mojave. And in the Sonoran Desert, we also get a monsoon in the summer, and so they do a lot of feeding then. You know, if it's not such a good year and there's not as much herbaceous growth, they'll feed on other things like cactus. In fact, that's one of the telltale signs that you can recognize when you go for a hike in the desert. If you see the prickly pear cactus with bites taken out of it, there's a good chance it was a desert tortoise. It might be a bighorn sheep, but their bite mark's quite a bit larger. Because they also are very good at dispersing seeds as well. So they do, by consuming these plants, they do play a role in engineering the desert ecosystem.
How long do desert tortoises tend to live?
Well, I've heard reports that desert tortoises can live up to a century. In the wild, we don't have very good data on the life expectancy, but certainly several decades, 40, 50 years. When they reach about 20 years of age, they're mature. And that's when they become full-grown and they're relatively safe from predation. A lot of the young hatchlings, they're like desert popcorn. Everybody likes to eat them. Once they reach that age of about two decades, they're pretty safe, and they have 98% survival at that point.
Wow. You mentioned they come out during the rains in the springtime or otherwise. Mm-hmm. I would imagine one of the cues for the tortoise to come out is thunder. Or lightning, or do they have a chemical reaction, perhaps, to nitrogen being released in the atmosphere?
Yeah, or barometric pressure. I don't know that that's been studied, but it is known, it's been described, that tortoises will come out of their burrows before it starts to rain. And in the Mojave, there's even reports of them building a little dam next to the burrow to catch some of the water. I mean, you know, they live in a desert environment, and they have incredible adaptations for dealing with that environment. They can store water in their bladder up to about 40% of their body weight. In the spring, they drink all the water for the year that they're ever going to get, and they store it, and then they use that to help them process their food for the rest of the year. All desert animals have some adaptations for dealing with a severe dearth of water. Desert animals have special adaptations in their kidneys for eliminating toxins, and they have much stronger urine. There's actually the desert kangaroo rat can go its entire life without drinking a single drop of water. They can get water from plant matter that doesn't even contain water. They can metabolically convert fats to water. So they're another one that has incredible adaptations for that desert environment.
Translocation of the kangaroo rats. Can you talk a little bit about what translocation is?
Mm-hmm.
And then let's go into what the kangaroo rats are doing.
Sure. Well, we have several local species of what we call heteromyets. Those are the pocket mice and the kangaroo rats. And several of them are endangered, and we're partnering with Fish and Wildlife to work with Pacific pocket mouse and the Stevens kangaroo rat, for example. And Dr. Deborah Shire is working to reestablish some populations of kangaroo rats. What we're doing is we're trying to understand aspects of their behavior and ecology before we relocate these animals. Because if you just catch an animal, pick them up, take them someplace and dump them, they may not fare very well. And it's important to use science and ecological knowledge to guide those. And for example, in some very interesting studies that we just conducted last year, we've learned that we can increase their chances of survival and adaptation to a new environment simply by spreading scent around, their own scent. This dampens dispersal from the release site so they don't wander off and expose themselves to more risks. it affects their ability to survive and thrive. The other thing we looked at was, even though these animals are solitary, they're nocturnal species, and they're solitary and territorial, they still live in neighborhoods. They know their neighbors. And if you just capture these animals willy-nilly and release them willy-nilly, not only do they have to pay a lot of cost in exploring their novel environment, avoiding predators, things like that, but they have to invest in establishing new social relationships with their new neighbors. And we found by simply moving a group of a neighborhood of these animals together, again, we can increase their ability to survive and thrive. It's a common conservation tool. It's also a tool for dealing with developmental activities where animals are displaced. And all too often, organizations involved in these haven't bothered to even follow up. I think an essential part of any translocation or release program is you have to follow them. And that usually involves some sort of radio telemetry, GPS satellite telemetry, so you can track them, find them, and find out how they're doing. And if there are problems, you know about them, and you can address them.
Well, let me ask you about a couple of the other species that you're familiar with. For example, I mentioned the San Clemente Island loggerhead shrikes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, San Clemente Island is one of the Channel Islands off the coast of Southern California here. Mm-hmm. It enjoys pretty much a Mediterranean climate like we have in coastal Southern California. Mm-hmm. What is a shrike?
A shrike is a bird, they're a medium-sized bird, gray with black and white. They have a hooked bill. They catch insects and lizards and eat them. And they're best known for their habit of collecting their prey and impaling them on thorn bushes to store them. So they have a bush full of their food. That's their refrigerator of the food that they store up.
Now, why are they endangered? I mean, they're only on San Clemente Island.
Yeah. And so the usual suspects, habitat loss, invasive predators in this case is a big thing. Cats and rats that were introduced to the islands have decimated those populations. That program is run by Dr. Susan Faribault, who works for us at the San Diego Zoo. And we're working with the Fish and Wildlife Service and the U.S. Navy to recover that species. And what we've done in this case is brought them in from the wild and established breeding centers, much like the condor. And we've had a great deal of success. We've bred hundreds of birds over the years and been releasing them back to their native habitat. And I believe now virtually all of the current wild population of these birds can trace its ancestry back, at least in part, to these birds that we've bred.
Dr. Ron Swaysgood, the Director of Applied Animal Ecology at the San Diego Zoo's Institute for Conservation Research. Really nice having you on the program today. We don't talk a lot about animals, literally about animals, about species, on this program very often. So it's really fun to talk about this kind of thing. And I think it's just remarkable the wealth of experience you bring to the table just with your experience with rhinos and pandas, perhaps because they're such exotic animals for folks here in the United States.
It was my pleasure. I enjoyed talking with you, Tommy.
Thanks very much, Dr. Swaysgood. We will talk to you next time. Good luck with the center outside of Las Vegas. And again, the website is www.sandiegozoo.org/conservation. Thank you again, Dr. Swaysgood.
Thank you.
That'll do it for this week's edition of Tree Huggers International on KBZT FM 94.9. Many thanks again to Dr. Ron Swaysgood, the Director of Applied Animal Ecology at the San Diego Zoo's Institute for Conservation Research, coming by and talking about his work with the desert tortoise and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's Desert Tortoise Center, as well as Dr. Swaysgood's work with other endangered species. The Desert Tortoise Center is located in Clark County, Nevada, just south of Las Vegas, and while it's a research facility at this point, they hope to have a portion of the center open to the public within about a year, so keep checking back, we'll let you know. Again, for more information about the San Diego Zoo and the San Diego Zoological Society, go to www.sandiegozoo.org. Better yet, try sandiegozoo.org/conservation. That's www.sandiegozoo.org/conservation. You can also call 619-231-1515. That's 619-231-1515. The opinions and views expressed on Tree Huggers International do not necessarily reflect the opinions and views of the staff and management of FM 94.9 or Lincoln Financial Media, and as producer, I am solely responsible for this program's content. Questions, complaints, concerns, compliments, go ahead and let me know. You can email me at tommy@fm949sd.com. And for more information on Tree Huggers International and to hear previous editions of the show, go to the Tree Huggers International page at the FM949 website. You can go to that at fm949sd.com. Go to the Tommy page, my DJ page, and you can link over to the Tree Huggers International page from there. This is Tommy Howe for Tree Huggers International on KBZT FM 94.9. We'll be back again next Sunday morning at 5:30 with another take on natural science and environmental affairs in our corner of Southern California and the Southwest. But in the meantime, get ready for another edition of Nina Blackwood's New Wave Nation. It's on the way next on FM 94.9. Have a great Sunday and a good week. Be well.